You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Here's a little bit from the Washington Post today in the section Middle East. After nearly 30,000 airstrikes for every day for more than 3 years, on November 26, not a single airstrike was launched against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Just a week earlier, Iraq's military had won back the last sliver of territory controlled by the militants, and the Pentagon has now announced that 400 Marines deployed to Syria to fight them are going to be coming home. The Washington Post says those milestones appear to mark the Islamic State's defeat with the end of its self-declared caliphate. Is that true? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about a story in the Washington Post. Islamic State's caliphate has been toppled in Iraq and Syria. Why isn't anyone celebrating? Joining us to talk about it, Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, author of several books on Islam, including his latest Confessions of an Islamophobe. Robert, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be here, Todd. Thank you.
Can you answer the question with the headline, Islamic State's caliphate has been toppled in Iraq and Syria? What's the answer to the question, why isn't anyone celebrating?
Probably because the Islamic State, in its heyday, attracted 30,000 young fighters from 100 countries around the world, many of which are in the West, France, Germany, the UK, the United States, Canada. Those are citizens of those countries, and they're coming home. And the authorities, in general, of all those nations, do not think they can do anything to keep them from coming home because they are citizens. And so they are going to come back and they're going to wreak havoc in their home countries and continue to pursue the jihad here. There are as many as 400 jihadis from the Islamic State running around loose right now in the UK. And nobody has said, wait a minute, these are enemy combatants. These are citizens of a country or an entity, we should say, that has repeatedly declared that it is at war with the UK, with the West in general. And so we should at least bar these people from returning or imprison them upon returning. And yet that's not been done. It's not been done in the UK and it's not been done elsewhere.
So is part and only part of the problem that they are thinking about the Islamic State in terms of the territory it controls?
Well, of course, the territory controls is substantially reduced, and that is a good thing. But these people are very much with us. Many of them have been killed, but many of them have not. And they've repeatedly called for attacks in the West. So paradoxically, even though it was a great thing and it was very highly necessary to topple the Islamic State and to destroy its holdings in Iraq and Syria, at the same time, it could end up being worse in the short run for the West for having done so.
How important is it that the Supreme Court, I believe, just yesterday decided to uphold President Trump's travel ban, so-called travel ban?
Well, it's extraordinarily important because while many of the Islamic State fighters are citizens of Western countries, at the same time, there are many others who have come in infiltrating the refugee stream. Tashfeen Malik, one of the San Bernardino shooters, she killed, along with her husband, 15 people at a Christmas party in San Bernardino in December 2015, she was a refugee. She had been vetted by 5 separate U.S. agencies and given a clean bill of health by all of them and got into the country. This just shows that it is well nigh impossible to distinguish peaceful refugees from Islamic jihadis. There are other refugees who have also committed jihad attacks in the U.S. and consequently we have the hard choice, Todd, of either leaving out, keeping out some harmless people or bringing in some harmful people. But we do not have another choice. And for years we've been told we have to bring in these harmful people because we cannot distinguish them and we're racist and bigoted and Islamophobic if you say, no, keep out the harmless people. But now President Trump is trying to put national security first.
So let's return to the issue of Syria and Iraq. The other implication, actually the statement of the Washington Post piece, is that this brings the caliphate to an end. Is the caliphate dependent upon whether or not the Islamic State is able to hold territory in any given country?
Yeah, to a great degree it actually is, because the caliphate is the sole legitimate government to which all Muslims owe allegiance. At least that's Sunni Muslim theology. Now, one of the great attractions, one of the reasons why the Islamic State was able to attract 30,000 Muslims from around the world to Iraq and Syria was because it was claiming to be the caliphate. The restoration of the caliphate, which was abolished by the secular Turkish government in 1924, and jihad groups have all had since then one of their primary goals being the restoration of the caliphate. This was a very powerful part of its appeal. But with no territory, no significant territory being controlled, it's going to be much harder for them to sustain that idea. And so I don't think they're going to be attracting people at the rate that they did before, although certainly there is evidence that they are still attracting people, and there is a clear indication that that includes Americans. Still not at the rate that they did before they lost all their land.
Explain the Islamic idea of a caliphate.
Caliph means successor, and the caliph is the successor of Muhammad as the military, political, and spiritual leader of the Muslims. And so for the abolition of the caliphate in 1924, at that time, that was considered to be a great catastrophe. And the Islamic Jihad groups ever since then have said, really, that's where all our troubles began, because we have been divided, disunited, and been controlled by the Western powers ever since. We have to restore the caliphate, unite all the Muslims underneath it, and then that will restore the glory of Islam, and we'll be able to wage jihad against the non-Muslims the way that we are commanded to do. This is something that has been part of this jihadi aspiration all these years. And the Islamic State seemed for a couple of years there as if it was actually realizing it, and that Allah was enabling the restoration of the caliphate and protecting it. But now, of course, that can't be said anymore.
Is the Islamic State's claim to a caliphate the only one in currency nowadays in Islam?
Yes. There have been others over the past few years. You may recall Mullah Omar, who was the leader of the Taliban until he died a few years ago. Mullah Omar, he in the 90s, when Al-Qaeda was just getting started and when all of that was really beginning, he claimed to be the caliph. But he never, except for one Algerian group, he never got traction for his claim outside of Afghanistan. The Islamic State was different because it was able to control a significant expanse of territory and did so for a couple of years. It was able to make a far more convincing case.
How does the Islamic world look at the claims of the Islamic State, generally speaking?
Well, obviously the Muslim countries in the world today, they all rejected the claim of the Islamic State, because to object, to have accepted it, would have been to deny their own sovereignty and deny their own reason and right to exist. And so they all had vested interests in not accepting the ISIS claim. Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood has been trying to establish the caliphate for decades, ever since it started in 1928. So it viewed the ISIS claim as competition, never accepted it. The Muslim Brotherhood groups in the U.S., likewise, they never accepted it, and that includes all the major mainstream Islamic groups in the U.S. And Al-Qaeda and the others also did not accept it, because here again, it was a matter of competition and market share. At the same time, it isn't as if these groups and these countries were all moderate and rejecting it on some kind of idea that Islam taught peace and did not call for warfare against unbelievers. That was taken for granted by everyone concerned. But it was just it was not that they didn't want a caliphate. It was that that wasn't the caliphate they wanted.
One of the State Department representatives says of the individual fighters associated with the Islamic State, we fully expect them to go back to their insurgent roots. What do you make of that observation?
Well, that's likely to be so. Yeah, those who have still maintained their faith in ISIS, they will go back to staging terror attacks, but that's where it becomes more dangerous for the West and more dangerous for the United States as well, because they're going to be coming here.
What should be done then? You said that the airstrikes have been largely effective, that this is good news, but what needs to be done now and next?
Well, we need to strengthen the travel ban, increase the number of countries it encompasses. We need to call upon Muslim groups in the United States to institute transparent, honest, inspectable programs that teach young Muslims why they should reject the ISIS understanding of Islam. There is not a single such program anywhere in the country right now in any mosque or Islamic school. And we need to make sure that it is very clear to Muslims in the United States that there is going to be no plotting of this kind, even if it is ostensibly peaceful. I'm referring in particular, for example, to groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hizb ut-Tahrir is an international Islamic organization. It's legal in many countries and illegal in many other countries. It is legal in the United States. It holds an annual convention in Chicago, and it is openly calling for the restoration of the caliphate and the establishment of Sharia in the United States and around the world. That has to be made abundantly clear that that is seditious behavior and is not going to be tolerated.
Should we be concerned about where the money for the Islamic State and other organizations like it is coming from?
Oh, certainly, because, you know, you're talking about an extraordinarily wealthy organization. I mean, of course, at its height, it controlled 60 oil wells in the in Iraq and was selling the oil on the black market. But then you got to ask, okay, who was buying it? And that leads to some very uncomfortable questions, because a lot of the evidence points to Turkey buying it, and Turkey is supposed to be our NATO ally. And so in the first place, we have to reconfigure our international alliances in order to make it very clear that we are fighting against jihad, we are allied with states that are against jihad, and we are in opposition to states that are aiding jihad, including some that are ostensibly allies of the U.S. right now, specifically Turkey and Pakistan.
Does the toppling of the Islamic State's caliphate in Iraq and Syria mean the end of the Islamic State?
No, not at all. I think that it'll go on. It's got a foothold in Libya. It's got a foothold in the Philippines, although it was recently crushed there in a battle with the Filipino army in Mindanao. It was not wiped out. And it does have a great deal of the wealth it amassed when it did control those 60 oil wells. It also has wealthy donors, although I don't know how many of them have continued with it after the fall of the caliphate. That was probably the appeal for them as well. But I suspect that this is still quite a well-heeled group and that we're going to be dealing with it for quite some time.
Are there any Islamic groups in the United States that you know of who have been so bold as to speak out against the Islamic State openly, to open up and be completely transparent about where money that they raise goes elsewhere?
Well, sure, there are many Muslim groups that have denounced the Islamic State, but you're talking about the major Muslim groups in the United States, like the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim American Society, and so on. Those are all Muslim Brotherhood groups, and so they don't disapprove of the idea of the caliphate in itself. They just don't want the ISIS caliphate, and they are hardly transparent about where their money is coming from. Many, many questions have been raised about that legitimately. Never been investigated. The Council on American Islamic Relations was under investigation by the Justice Department, but Barack Obama in 2009 put a stop to that investigation, and it has not been revived. It should be.
Those should be revived, you said.
Yes, the investigation needs to be revived, and the investigation needs to encompass where CARE is getting all its money.
Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch, and he's author of several books on Islam, including his latest, Confessions of an Islamophobe. When you purchase it using the Amazon link, At our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for Confessions of an Islamophobe by Robert Spencer. Robert, thank you very much for being our guest.
Pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Sharif Girgis. He has written recently in the New York Times and in public discourse about the Christian baker and his legal dilemma, what finds itself in the Supreme Court case Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Stay tuned.
Holiday shopping season, skip the Fruit of the Month Club. Don't fall for any ridiculous as-seen-on-TV offers. Just say no to ugly sweaters. Instead, give your family and friends the best of Lutheran reflection on faith and life, theology and culture, delivered monthly right to their mailboxes. Give them the Lutheran Witness magazine. Visit cph.org/witness to purchase subscriptions for Christmas or anytime. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. EMMANUELPress.US.
It was the day after Christmas in 1538 when family and friends who were gathered around Luther's table heard him say, "There is no finer gift that a parent can give to a child than an education in the liberal arts." For over 100 years, St. Paul's Lutheran School in Brookfield, Illinois, has been emphasizing the six chief parts and the seven liberal arts, providing classical education in the Lutheran tradition. Visit our website at spbrookfield.org or call 708-485-0650.
This Christmas, bring your family and friends to experience a reenactment of the Christmas story and Journey to the Manger, an interactive Christmas experience.
Enjoy a live nativity, warm drinks and cookies, and live music performed by student groups.
From 5 to 8 p.m. on December 22nd, come to Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, to enjoy this Christmas experience for all ages.
Admission is free, and when you donate $25 or more, you'll receive a custom piece of art made by our students.
For more information,
call 618-656-0043.
Merry Christmas!
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In the early 90s, communication scholars began talking about the old concept of the newspaper. You know, those things on paper with ink?
Terry Mattingly speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The concept behind this, they called it the Daily We. That there was supposed to be a media product that we would consume that would help us learn about other people in our community, in our nation, and that we would at least be consuming some of the same information for the sake of debate, discourse, etc. The internet is absolutely brilliant at destroying the Daily We.
You can listen to Terry Mattingly's presentation, Making the Case for News Discernment, on an audio DVD of both of our 2017 Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $300. Just click the DVD logo at issuesetc.org.